Meeting of the group Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend.
Preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting, declining outside contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. It does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The Beacon Group insists on providing a safe and effective meeting place so all who wish to recover from alcoholism, therefore, we ask all attendees to foster a secure and welcoming environment, refraining from any behavior that may compromise another's safety. As our traditions remind us, our common welfare is paramount. Each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of a great whole. For more information about safety in AA, see the AA safety card and safety card and AA. Wow. Okay. Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
I have asked Devin to read the steps.
Hello. My name is Devin. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 steps. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought for prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And number 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Fight for the microphone.
That's okay. Thanks. All right. Tonight is anniversary night, and as such, we will be honoring our celebrants at the start of the meeting. Tonight, we have three celebrants. Would the celebrants please join me on stage? We take this time each month to recognize group members as they mark milestones in their sobriety. It is our belief that pausing in gratitude for these milestones provides hope, inspiration, and also fosters love and support for one another. We ask everyone to keep in mind the number of celebrants and the end time of the meeting. It is group conscious that celebrants try to limit their share to a minute or so. And now please join me in singing the happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary to the
celebrants.
Happy anniversary to the celebrants. Happy anniversary, dear celebrants.
Oh, wow.
Happy anniversary.
Our first celebrant is Christina with 12 years.
Hi, I'm Christina. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Christina.
I am... You usually think about what I'm going to say, and I have not given it any thought. I'm super grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and for this program. You know, like, it saved my life. I got sober when I was 23, and I was going to die if I kept drinking or just live like a really, really miserable life. And I'm really grateful that AA existed, that people in my family knew what AA was, that hospitals and institutions knew what AA was, and that people could point me here to get the help that I needed and to develop, right, like a relationship with God. That is what has sustained my sobriety throughout. And, you know, I have a beautiful life today, and I attribute that entirely to being sober. You know, like, I know what I would look like if I was still drinking. So if you're new, and you know, I mean, it's exciting tonight to see people with like solid time. Like, the fact that the first celebrant is 12 years is cool. So if you're new and that feels really, really far away, like, just keep coming, come to meetings, get a sponsor, work the steps. If you're afraid to ask someone to be your sponsor, just talk to somebody after the meeting, and just keep trying, right? Like, do the work that, as it's outlined in the big book, and you know, the promises that are outlined here. I was joking with a friend who's a new mom the other day about, like, there's kind of a formula to raising kids. Not that I raise a lot of kids, but I have one, and she's pretty cool. And I have another one coming. And I was like, you know, it's kind of like, if you do certain things, like, you probably will get a certain outcome. And she was like, yeah, kind of like the steps. And I was like, yeah, kind of like that. So that's it. Thanks.
Thanks, Christina.
Maria with 24 years.
We're alcoholic. And it's so neat, because really there's four of us up here, yeah. And we can remember that after the baby comes.
Yeah.
I forgot this was at the beginning, so I didn't have enough time to prepare a whole minute of material. So I apologize. I think this was at the end, like 10 years ago. I think it used to be at the end, and we moved it so there'd be enough time to eat the cake, just so you know. I wasn't wrong. I just misremembered. So I like to come up here and celebrate my anniversary here. This is my home group for many years. My current home group is... it was Orleans Young People until last week, but now Orleans Young People is now Brewster Young People because we moved. So you can call us EYP now. And because having a home group is this like wonderful experience of having a safe place to work out the battle of sobriety, and having a place where I feel comfortable walking in the door, having a place where I know the people in that room know me, even if it's a bigger meeting like here, and even if it's many years later, I still feel like people know me here. And I just think about what a valuable gift that is from Alcoholics Anonymous to have, like, we have this amazing network literally across the globe where we can walk into rooms and feel known and welcome and good and accepted. I mean, it isn't always perfect, but most of the time it is, and I challenge you to give me another example of a place where people go and feel that good about, you know, fighting this battle for the light all the time. So thank you for my sobriety.
With 27 years.
Good evening, Sam Alcoholic. I take this medallion from my cousin Amanda. She was 17 when she was killed in a drunk driving accident her freshman year at Boulder in a rollover. She was crushed to death underneath of the car. I stopped drinking March 18th, 1994, but I didn't go to meetings. February 4th, 1996, I claim my sobriety date. I was 27 years old. This medallion is for 27 years of sobriety. I was homeless. I came in off the streets. I moved to Boston 2016. I credit service work, and it's fun to see my former delegate here, who's our speaker tonight. I was a general service representative. My home group is the Lexington Saturday 10 a.m. First Shot meeting, which is a hybrid. We've got 120 people, 45 on Zoom and the rest in the room. And what I want to recommend, if you're in this room and you're wondering if you're an alcoholic, please stay. Life out there doesn't get better. And what I remember from my sobriety is that I am grateful to those who came before me, who reached out the hand of AA to help walk me through, who sat with me, who came to coffee shops before and after the meeting, who watched me turn 1 year sober, who introduced me to sober skiing, sober jet skiing, sober poker, which I suck at. And, you know, a lot of the sober bowling and other fun activities that we do, because I don't get sober just to stop drinking. I get sober to have a new way of life, and so that I can work and coexist with the other people out in the world who are not alcoholic, who don't have a program. So for my cousin Amanda, who would have been 48 years old today, I celebrate this in honor that this is a fatal disease, and if you show up, suit up, and do the work, you can have a life beyond your wildest dreams. Thank you.
Thank you all, celebrants. Congratulations. Tonight, our 10-minute speaker is Jules.
Hey everyone, I'm Jules. I'm an alcoholic.
Jules.
And I figure out what to do with my hands up here. Hi, it's good to be here. Never been here before. 10 minutes, let's see. My sober date is September 14th, 2021. So next month I'll have 18 months. It's my first time coming around. I have a sponsor. Sponsor, all that good stuff. So I think I'll just talk about how I was like in the very beginning, and then at the very end when it comes to like my experience as an alcoholic. When I was a kid, like I was kind of like a very like serious kid, always in my head, overthinking a lot of things. I was always kind of like in conflict all the time with like wanting to stand out in a crowd, but also not wanting to risk being too honest or being my true self around people. I thought it'd make me like very vulnerable, and I didn't want people to have like a reason to criticize me in any type of way. I was always concerned with like wanting people's affection and people liking me, and that never really went away, to be honest. When I picked up a drink for the first time, I felt like, I don't know if it helped me be more honest about like who I was and what I wanted to do or any of that stuff, but all the masks that I had been wearing for a long time just seemed like easier to put on, or I forgot that I was wearing them, so things were a lot more enjoyable, and I felt like a huge sense of relief. I realized like now, because of the program, that you know I am where I'm supposed to be at any given time, and I think that's true. Like when I had my first drink, I was exactly where I was supposed to be, and that relief that I felt was for a reason. I don't know exactly why yet, but given the way things are going, like more and more things get revealed to me every day, so I'll find out when the time comes. Towards the end of my drinking, like the last 3-4 years of my drinking, you know, drugs are part of my story, mostly just because the drugs I was doing helped me drink the way that I wanted to, you know what I mean? So like I stopped blacking out and passing out when I should have. So, you know, the last year it was basically me waking up early to open the doors where I worked. Somehow my boss like trusted me with the keys and opening up and closing up that place every day. And, you know, I'd wake up and I'd grab a drink, go in the shower, drink in the shower, get out of the shower, have another drink, do cocaine, run out the door. I lived in Porter Square, so if you've ever taken the train there, like I would just like run straight down those escalators to the train. Hopefully if I get to Harvard enough time to make the liquor store before I have to go on the bus and get to work. So by the time I get to work at like 9:45, I'm like 5-7 drinks deep and I have like a head full of coke, and I'm just like, I have more booze on me, just not to get drunk, but just to like stay afloat and not get sick. And then I just go home and drink on the bus home, blah, blah, blah. Basically, it was just the same thing like every single day. And every day when I woke up, like I just felt like I was facing a sentence to just live another day. And for a long time, I thought that I didn't care whether I lived or died. You know, like I would cross the street in Cambridge where I lived without like looking both ways. And then like one day, like something happened and I, you know, I bought a bag off my drug dealer, and it ended up being like, you know, caught with something. And I woke up with like EMT standing over me asking me when my birthday was, and I couldn't answer them. And, you know, things kind of changed after that. It ended up being my mother's birthday, and I wasn't with my mom at the time, but, you know, that's how I remember it, because I just didn't have the nerve to call her the next day. Because every time I talked to her on the phone, she'd always ask me like how I was doing, and I was getting tired of lying to her. So, you know, that was in August. I had an apartment lined up for the end of the month, but it fell through because I couldn't get anything together for it in time. So I had to move in back with my folks, stop doing the drugs to help me not black out. So every time I put a drink in my mouth, I would black out. And I eventually told them what happened. You know, I told them that I was legally dead for like, I guess, like 8 minutes. My mother asked me, you know, if I kept using after that, and I realized that I was gonna die if I kept drinking, because I knew like every time I drank, like I was basically just, you know, signing a contract without reading it. Like I didn't know what was gonna happen. And I was just looking like gnarlier and gnarlier and gnarlier every day. Like when I looked in the mirror, I didn't really recognize myself. And I wasn't losing anything anymore because I wasn't gaining anything. And the only thing I saw in my life progressing was my disease. So I decided that I was too tired to keep going. So I agreed to go to rehab, go to detox, go to rehab. I remember like immediately regretting it because I was like, oh, now I really got to go. And you know, I went and it was crazy. It was, I remember like the first week, second week I was there. I mean, that was the longest time in over 10 years that I'd gone that long without a drink. And, you know, they exposed me to the big book. And I mean, really the most important thing that I found out when I was in rehab was, you know, there was one woman who really spoke to me and, you know, she just told me, like, just make sure you go to a meeting. Like, first thing, like, don't sleep on it, just go. Like, that's where, like, the real recovery happens. So I followed her advice, and I met a lot of guys who, you know, showed me around and, you know, just exposed me to the big book. I got a sponsor right away. I'm really grateful today that, like, when I first started reading the big book, like, I had drank myself to the point where, like, the worst, you know, when I read the description of the hopeless alcoholic, I fit the description perfectly, and I'm so grateful for that, because I would not have taken this seriously at all if that was the case. You know what I mean? Like, I could have came in here when I was 20, but I didn't fit that description quite yet, so I feel like I just would have been in and out. But, you know, I don't know exactly what makes me an alcoholic. I don't know when it happened. I just know that I am now, and I know that, like, at the end of the day, it's all about like taking responsibility for it. And the only way I know how to really do that is to work this program, you know. I feel really blessed today. Like I've been meditating on it, and I realized that, like, you know, this desire to drink that's been removed from me, it almost is like a covenant with God. Like, it's an agreement with God. Like, I will remove this desire to drink from you, but with that being done, it'll expose all of these problems that you have, like, in your life, spiritually, mentally, physically. And once you're able to see that, you'll be able to fix them. So that's really the way that I've been trying to live my life, the more spiritual one. Because, I mean, I've been living a life without God for so long. I've been just trying to do it my way. Like, very kid stuff, you know, like when I was a kid, it fixed a lot of these problems. And for me, the insanity of the disease is like being a 30-year-old man and thinking that picking up a drink is gonna solve the problems that it did for me when I was like 15, 16 years old, you know? So I'm pretty sure that's 10 minutes, right? Huh? I got a minute and a half left? Okay. Actually, you know what? I'm really excited because this Saturday I'll be doing my fifth step, finally. I've been working on my fourth step for a little over a year. So anyone who's in the middle of that right now, you know, keep powering through it. You know, obviously I didn't work on it every day for a year because I would have been done by now. But I did... I'm glad that I did it the way that I did it, because it gave me time to really, like, meditate on the things that I was seeing, not just, like, write everything out and blah, 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 you know. I mean, it definitely gave me some time to, you know, add some names to the list while I was doing it, too. So, you know, and it showed me a lot about like being responsible. And it also like, you know, while I was doing the 4-step, I learned how to do a 10-step, which, you know, I wish somebody told me how to do that when I was in middle school, honestly. Like it really, I don't know, the power of being able to like call myself out on things and take responsibility, not just for my actions, but for my thoughts themselves, you know? Like for a long time, like even before I picked up a drink, like all this crazy like self-centered thinking I thought because it was like in my head and in my own voice, like I just assumed that it was truth. And this program taught me that that is not usually the case, so. I appreciate Gannon asking me to speak, and I look forward to the next speaker. Thank you.
All right, thank you so much, Jules. We will now observe the seven tradition. AA has no dues or fees for AA membership, but we do have expenses. The seven tradition states, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group expenses, the seven tradition is essential at every level of AA service. Since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, GSO has withdrawn approximately $4.5 million from the reserve fund. AA's usual suggestion is a $2 contribution per meeting. We are passing the basket, but you may also observe the seven tradition digitally on Venmo. For those of you, those of you in person, or you can see a QR code on the basket, and for those of you online, which there's none, our Venmo handle is @beacon-group. Again, although there are no dues or fees for AA membership, we do have expenses. Our rent is $400 per month. Please give what you can. Our treasurer, Amanda, will answer any questions, and we thank you in advance for your generosity. We also have a set of traditions. AA also has a set of traditions, which apply to the group in the same manner that the 12 steps apply to the individual. Tonight, Samantha has been asked to read the traditions.
Hi everyone, Samantha Alcoholic. Okay, one, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. Less problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you, Samantha. Beacon Group is run by a business meeting which meets on the third Wednesday of each month at 6:30 in a hybrid format, both here at St. Paul's Church and online. This is an opportunity to get more involved. All group members are encouraged to attend and participate. We hope you can join us. Will all group members please raise their hands? Thanks. And now let's welcome our main speaker, Sue.
everybody. I'm Sue. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sue.
Thank you for the chance to be here tonight. It's really great to be at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and just trying to get myself settled a little bit. As I said, I'm Sue. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Just for Today virtual meeting. We meet every day online at 6 a.m. and 7 a.m. I am at the 7 a.m., usually not at the 6 a.m. meeting. My sobriety date is July 9th of 1990, and I currently serve Area 30 as a past delegate. I am the Panel 67 past delegate, and I'm also the chair of the Welcome Committee for the upcoming Northeast Regional Forum, which is going to be held in Burlington, Massachusetts, June 2nd through 4th. And trust me, you're going to hear all about it in a few minutes. As I said, thank you for the invitation. I'm feeling pretty blank tonight, which is unusual. I've had a little while to think about this, and usually I get in my head, and it's like, oh my God, I got to tell him this. And like tonight, I'm like, I don't know what's going to come out of my mouth. So, okay, God, let's go. And it was really great to be here on anniversary night, and congratulations to all of you who are celebrating. And it was really good to hear all the different things you said about home groups and about the steps and about sponsorship. And all of that is just so very important. And thank God I had the chance and I stayed alive long enough to get here to start hearing about those things. I grew up in an alcoholic home. There are four kids in my family. Three of us are adopted. And I was one of the adoptees. So I was adopted into the alcoholic home, and it was kind of my ongoing thing with God most of my life. It was like, you know, you had this chance to put me in a really great place, and you want, and here, this is really, this is where it wound up. I have a brother and a sister who are just really gifted athletes, and you know, like just the beautiful people. And I grew up with glasses, braces, orthopedic shoes, and I played the cello. So from the get-go, that not fitting in thing was just all about it. And like not fitting in my own skin, not knowing what was going on. And what I know now is there was an unbelievable amount of grief. There was another child that died before my sister and I were adopted. And it was something that no one ever spoke about. And it was just like one day when I was probably in middle school, we were at the cemetery. My mom was talking about my brother's grave and like, wait, what? But that was something, and like knowing what I know now, there is no way that couldn't have affected all of us growing up. And so thinking about this soup of like all this unexpressed emotions, people who had no idea how to deal with any of that, but what we had when I went into the kitchen, there was always a lineup of pills on the counter, on the kitchen counter, and there was alcohol everywhere. We used to joke, like, so in my house, every other cabinet, if it didn't have some form of liquor, it had the right glassware. And we were the kind of family that you had to have the right glass for all the things. So like everywhere, it was always infused. When I was about 13 years old, my parents had a party. And if you went out the back door of the house, you had the patio where they had a bar set up because there were people over. And you would go down the path through the rose garden to another patio where there was a fridge with more alcohol just in case you needed it because it was too far to go back to the house. Then if you went down the steps, that's where they put the kegs for this particular party. Go down the further pass, past the wine cellar that my father had created for himself, and out to the gazebo where there was yet another fridge, and you know, with, filled with beer, and a phone so you could call to the house and have somebody run out alcohol just in case you ran out. But no, it was really not a priority in my family at all. I learned early how to drink. I learned that this is what we do, and that and I learned, like, this is how they were social. There was a cocktail dinner every night. The women in the neighborhood all get together. In the freezer, there was always something frozen. It was usually daiquiris. If there was a pitcher of something in the refrigerator, you better smell it first. My brother went one time thinking that he was drinking a pitcher of Kool-Aid, and it was a pitcher of sangria. And, like, he downed the thing and then passed out. But, like, these were the normal occurrences. But we were a high-functioning, good Catholic family. And this was like, this is just the way it was. I grew up in this thinking nothing, this was not out of the ordinary of anywhere else in the world. But then there was this twist. And my dad was getting angrier and angrier the more he drank. And my brothers were getting into trouble. And I started to understand that my brothers were doing things that we might call, you know, non-conference approved substances. I won't get into too much of that. But I started realizing that there's this other thing going in the family. So I've decided that the best course of action for me was to not drink. And so I was going to be the perfect daughter. And I just held everything together. And, You know, I heard someone say in a meeting that she battled the alcohol long before she really started drinking, and that was me. I knew that, like, something was really kind of off, so let me see what I could do. And what happened was I went on that way for a while, and then I graduated from high school and I moved away from home. I got to college, and the first weekend at college, I started drinking, and within 30 days, I was drinking every single day. All bets were off, nobody was watching me, it was not a problem. I had, you know, one of the things that was sort of the unwritten rule in my family was that it was okay for the boys to drink, but it was not okay for the girls to drink. There were very, very rigid gender roles. And I went to an all-women's college, nobody cared, and nobody was watching. And I started drinking, and I loved it. I loved it. I got out of the, you know, my room. I was social. I was funny. I started drinking, and, like, you never knew what was coming out of my mouth next. And, like, I became the mascot for all the seniors, which was awesome because they could buy. So, like, I would show up at the parties, and it was often, like, we'd have a dance or something, and most of the time they were putting me to bed, and, you know, I was easy. They were short sheeting my bed, and they were pulling all these pranks, and I was the mascot. So for a while, nobody noticed, and it was fine. But I'll tell you, within 6 months, some of my friends were looking at me going, huh, what's going on? What are you doing? Do you ever think maybe you're drinking a little too much? And it got to the end of my first, you know, year, and what happened was everybody was on me. So my reaction to that was I moved across campus and went, made an entirely new set of friends the next year, because then it was like I went and found people who drank that I did. And my second year on campus as a sophomore, I was the resident advisor on a floor full of seniors one more time, always surrounded by people who could buy. And it was an interesting thing. In a lot of other places, resident advisors were the counselors, and they were, you know, helping you out and telling you what to do, enforcing the laws. And I was the resident advisor that if you came to me with an issue, I directed you down the hall to the bathtub where we kept the keg, because there was always an open keg on the floor that I was on. It wasn't my job to enforce the rules, and I didn't have coping skills. That was the best I knew. Like, oh, you're having a bad day? There's the keg. You know, have at it. I ended up getting alcohol poisoning later that year because I did something like 12 shots of Bacardi 151 in a half hour and, like, just passed right out. I had no idea that it was anything different. But, like, that was the kind of recklessness that I was doing. No idea what was in, just drinking, because I was drinking to oblivion. I didn't know how to tell people what was starting to come on and what was starting to catch up. Because with all the alcohol, like, I wasn't telling you about the fact that as my dad got more angry, he got violent and he got abusive. I wasn't telling people about that. And it was all there. And honest to God, I'm grateful that I learned to drink, because I think it kept me alive long enough to eventually get here. But I went on like that, and things just sort of started falling out of my life. So by the time I became a senior, I was living in a dorm where I knew the names of maybe 5 women. I was not going to any of my classes. I kept one activity, which was there was a Shakespeare Society in the school that I went to. And basically, every night at 6 o'clock, I would get out of bed, and I would cross campus to the theater where we had all of our shows. And the great thing about that particular building is the costume room was in the basement, so I could go down into the basement where I had my stash hidden and drink by myself amongst the costumes. And it's an amazing thing to me that, like, I was on one of the most beautiful campuses, like, in the country, and I'm still drinking in the basement. Like, that's where it put me, and that was the best I knew how to do. I was convinced that if I got to class late, like, that, you know, the professor would stop everything and yell at me. There were some, like, really crazy things. I also was convinced that if I had my eyeliner on, you couldn't tell that there was anything wrong with me, because eyeliner was the key. And, you know, just really crazy things. But I stopped going to classes and really was on the verge of failing out. And what happened was one of the women in that Shakespeare Society looked at me and she said, hey, what are you doing for spring break? Like, I had no plans. And she knew that. She knew that I had no money because of the way I was drinking. And she said, why didn't you come to Maine? You can sit on the ocean, stare at the water. Nobody will bother you. I'm like, that's what I want. That is perfect. That is what I'm totally up for. Because at this point in time, what I didn't know how to tell you was that the drinking wasn't working anymore. And that the black hole that I had inside was getting louder. And that I was going into these crying jags where I would suddenly start crying for like 3 hours at a time and not know how to stop. And like the drinking wasn't doing it. And I didn't know what to do. And I thought, like, I didn't realize there was anything wrong with me, there was anything different. And I was watching people like go to class and fill out their resumes and get jobs because we were getting close to graduation. I had no idea. But I got my car and I went to go visit Tricia. And Tricia was staying that week with her boyfriend, who was also an AA. She told me that too. And I'm like, oh, that's great for people like Tricia. I had seen her, and throughout the year, we were working in the same Shakespeare Society, and we were the same shows. And, you know, and she had told me for a while that she was sober in AA. And I'm like, yeah, that's really great for people like her. And so when we were doing shows together, like I'd go up and do a show, which was on the, do my part on the stage, which is on the second floor of our theater, and then come down to the kitchen, drink as much as I could, and then go back on stage, because I was, that was how I lived my life. Except Tricia kept walking in the kitchen. And like she was always around, and like she'd come in, and like my beer would go into the microwave, behind the toaster, on the, like anywhere where she couldn't see that I was drinking. And she was watching the whole time because she was one of us. She knew like, oh yeah, she's got a problem. Like, and she told me later, she was like, I kept wondering myself, have you ever realized how much you were drinking? And so she just invited me to Maine. And like, okay, got my car, go to Maine. And that night we went out to dinner. And it suddenly occurred to me like, oh God, they're sober. Oh, I probably shouldn't order anything to drink. Maybe that's rude. Okay, all right, I'm not going to drink anything. And then the feeling inside me was just, like I had no words to describe it. And later on, like I read this thing that Bill Wilson wrote, and he talked about having that feeling of ground glass underneath your skin. And I'm like, that was exactly what I was feeling. Like I didn't know what to do because I couldn't drink, like I wasn't drinking through that. Like, and I was staying with people who weren't drinking, and I'm like, okay. So they got me rough and ready, and we got back to the apartment that night, and Tricia said, hey, I got this thing I need to do tomorrow morning. And I said, okay. And she's like, no big deal. I got to go speak to some kids over at the high school. You can come along if you want. And I am a good supportive friend, so I went along for the ride. And I went, and I sat in the back of the cafeteria, and they brought in all of the sophomores. And Tricia went down front, and she got on stage with a bunch of other people and proceeded to tell them what it was like, what happened, and what it was like now, because she was doing a public information commitment for Alcoholics Anonymous. And public information, if you don't know, is the service committee in AA that actually goes out to schools and colleges. It goes to health fairs. It basically wants to make sure that we are never so anonymous that the people who need us can't find us. So we go out on the road and we do all of these things to make sure that people can find us. I don't know if a single one of those sophomores got sober, but I looked at Trish afterwards and I said, do you still go to meetings? And she said, yes. I said, can I go sometime? And she said, of course, there's one tonight. And so, you know, that night was my first meeting. It was the Big Book meeting on Oars Island up in Maine. And it was one of the ones where they went around the room and they introduced themselves and they got to me and it fell out of my mouth like, yeah, I'm Sue, I'm an alcoholic. And Trisha's like, oh God, now what do I do? Because she's like, no one ever listened to me when I reached out to them before. But it was one of those really great meetings that what they did was immediately it became a step one meeting. And immediately everybody in the room started talking and sharing about how they got to AA, how they came to understand that they were powerless over alcohol and their lives had become unmanageable. And they geared the entire meeting to me. And a guy named Garth afterwards gave me his Big Book. And he said, you know, you're gonna need this. And I still have it. It is 32 years later. I still have that big, actually, it is just about 33 years later and I still have that Big Book. Like I've moved a lot and it comes with me everywhere I go. It's a third edition. And I'd love to tell you that I've been sober ever since. But the truth is there was someone else in the meeting who looked at me and said, well, little girl, I'm not sure you belong here. That was the guy I wanted to listen to. I hadn't even been legal for an entire year. Are you kidding me? Like, I don't know. But, you know, people gave me suggestions and I took them half-heartedly. And I went home and I went back to school and I didn't drink. And like, you know, I went to maybe a meeting a week. I did not do what people suggested might be helpful. I just didn't do it. I should also tell you that at this particular time in the society, we were doing a production of King Lear. And so as I'm getting sober, I'm involved in a production where I am the producer. And I actually was in charge of the sets, the costume, the lighting, and the scenery, as well as playing one of the major roles. So when I was reading through the big book and got to the part of the director, it was hitting really close to home, which has been an ongoing sort of joke with me and my higher power. Like, there is no wiggle room. Like, I'm going to spell it out. This is exactly what it's like for you. But later on, like, I came to see the beauty of that. What happened was, you know, I went back. I eventually graduated. I moved home, and about 30 days later, the bell went off. Once I moved home, I wasn't going to meetings. I hadn't even found them. And not surprising, I had no defense against the first drink. So I opened up my parents' cabinet, and I drank my dad's scotch, because I didn't know. And, you know, that lasted one night. What was really important to know is that I also had a case of hepatitis at the time. So drinking when you have a liver issue is really not, I don't recommend it. And I didn't know that I could come back to Alcoholics Anonymous because I hadn't been to enough meetings to understand that. And so I white-knuckled it for a little while and eventually said something to my sister-in-law, who told her mom. And her mom had been sober in AA for 12 and a half years at that point. And they didn't say, let's go to a meeting. They didn't, like, pull me in. What they said was, there's this yard sale up in Maine, and we can't do it without you. Because they knew exactly who I was, and I was such a people pleaser that it's like, okay, I've got to save the yard sale. I'll get my car. I'll drive to Maine. Like, I've got it. I'm on the way. Just hold on. So, of course, they didn't tell me that it was Rosalie's Sober Club's yard sale. Everybody that I met that day in the field was a sober alcoholic, and Rosalie made a point of telling all of the crotchety old guys that I'd been out drinking, man, did they have a good time. Like, I was harassed mercilessly from the second I showed up, which was exactly what I needed, because I felt so much of a part of. And so I picked up we went to the shelter meeting that night, and I picked up what has been my last white chip. And you know, that was in July of 1990. When I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, when I came home, I started taking the suggestions I didn't take the first time. Trisha had looked at me and said, you like coffee, you should make coffee, just make coffee. People could tell you a lot of things, I'm gonna tell you, make coffee. So at my second meeting back, I became the coffee maker of the meeting. I went into the back, and it took me like five times going into the kitchen, and I didn't even start the conversation. They looked at me, was like, honey, what do you need? And I was told to make coffee, and they're like, great, here's the key to the hall. You can make coffee next week. And I'm like, no, wait a minute, I didn't mean for that to happen. But they held a business meeting and made me the coffee maker, and next week they showed up to help me make the coffee. And it was one of those old kitchens where they stored the bowls in the cabinet, and I opened the cabinet, and I reached for the bowls, and they slid through my fingers, and they shattered on the linoleum floor. And I went into that super paralysis, like, time for me to go. And they're like, got the other bowls, and we're like, keep coming, it's gonna get better. And like, that has been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, come in, like, I feel like I screwed up and broke up, and you're gonna throw me out. I'm like, no, honey, keep coming, it's gonna get better. I am so grateful for that. My first original home group, I really became part of, would go on commitments, did all the things. My life changed pretty drastically in my first year. My father had a major stroke, and my family went bankrupt, but I had that home group, and like, I had the same meetings that I went to every single week, and that's what I was doing. I did a lot of, okay, don't drink, go to meetings, ask for help. I built up a fellowship. And then a group of us came down. I was living then up in Topsfield, and we came down to South Boston on Friday nights because there was a Big Book Step Study meeting at St. Peter and Paul's, and I was introduced to the steps out of the Big Book. And that's where I started, really diving in. And what I loved about that meeting was the way that they treated the active drunks who showed up at the meeting. And there was a woman, and all I knew about her is her name was Alice, and she was a part of General Service. But every week she would meet the active drunks at the door, and she'd look at them going, hey, I'll trade you that bottle for a cup of coffee, and why don't you come sit down front and sit with me? And the absolute humanity that she showed other people just blew me away. And that was something I knew I wanted. And I continued to work the steps, and unbelievably, there was an amazing group of people there that they're like, we do other things too. And let us tell you about the Mass State Conference of Young People in Alcoholics Anonymous, because they had all been a part of it the year before and went on advisory council. And so I ended up becoming involved in service outside of the group. And I eventually started attending the WIPOC conventions and served on a bunch of different committees over the years. And that changed everything. I started learning about the traditions and how it worked. And I remember one night after a really brutal committee meeting, there was an advisory council member there. And, you know, the host committee that is doing the work and advisory council has done it before, and they're coming to give you suggestions. And often the host committee and the advisory council doesn't see eye to eye. So I was having an argument with this guy one night, and I brought up the traditions and like thought I made a great point, so he brought up the concepts. I had no idea what he was talking about. So I went home and looked them up because I was never losing an argument with him again. And I hate to say it, but that is the way like I found some of the principles here. And it made me dive in. I am so grateful for that. I didn't stay there. Serving on MISCIPA helped me. I became the area liaison. I got involved a little bit more in service that way. I eventually moved over to general service. And for those of you who don't know, in AA, once our founders, Bill and Bob, passed away, and well, as they were starting to die, we knew we had to have come up with a way to like make decisions so that AA could continue long after they were gone. So every year we hold a week-long business meeting, and that's going to be coming up in April. And there are 93 different areas across the United States and Canada, and each of these areas sends one person to that business meeting to represent all of you and what your voice is and what you want and what is best for Alcoholics Anonymous. And the honor and privilege of serving as the delegate to the General Service Conference in 2017 and 2018. And I still cry thinking about it. Like the fact that Area 30 entrusted me to carry their voice just blows me away. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was an amazing thing because I knew I was going to represent the people and like show up and carry the voice of the people who are doing the work every single day, because it doesn't matter what you're doing in service, we're all equal. We need every part of you. And if you came tonight to set up the chairs or make the coffee or make sure that the door is open, if you're greeting somebody, if you're doing sponsorship work, all of that is so necessary and important for this AA to be here for the next sick and suffering alcoholic. You know, I'm so amazed that two men met in 1935, and here in 2023, we're in 180 countries around the world. The Big Book has been translated into 71 different languages, the most recent being American Sign Language and an oral-only version of Navajo that was able to carry the message to people who had never heard it before. And that happened in 2017. It was very recent. You know, all of that is done because of the dollars you put in the basket. And I just want to thank you all for showing up and being members of AA, and like you've saved my life and the lives of so many others. If any of this is interesting to you, I want to let you know that the General Service Office in New York goes out on the road and travels a lot, and they put on what they call a forum. And that's where they come out, and it is the trustees, and it is the staff people. It is the people who work in the literature. It's the people who work on the grapevine. And they bring all of the things that they are working on out to where we can see it, and they meet us where we are. In June 2nd through 4th, that will be in Burlington, Massachusetts, at the Burlington Marriott. Please come. You know, more information will be coming soon. Registration will be, flyers will be out on March 6th. There will be more information coming. It is free. You can come and just meet the people because they really want to meet you. They want to know what's going on, and you can meet the people that are doing all this work, that, you know, for Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason why they want to meet you is there's this really interesting thing about AA. 2023, not 1935. Who'd have thunk? You know, when I got sober, we didn't even have email. We didn't even have call waiting, for God's sakes. And so now when we think about how we carry the message, we have to update the tools or we are not going to reach the sick and suffering alcoholics. You know, for me, it was always you could look in the phone book, look in the newspaper. We don't do that anymore. Well, where do we do it and how do we do that? And AA has been looking over the past few years to figure out how to do this with apps or whether pamphlets are the right thing anymore. You know, who are we supposed to be doing pamphlets? Does it now need to be infographics? There's so many different things that we're talking about to make sure that AA and our message of hope and recovery will be there for the next sick and suffering alcoholic. So I know this group has a group service representative. Please pay attention to them. They'll be talking about what's going to be on the agenda for that big business meeting this year. Make sure that you tell people what's going on because it's so important. It's so important for you to weigh in. So we make sure that AA continues to represent all of our voices. Because like I said, there may be an alcoholic just a block away from here struggling to get sober. Let's make sure that AA continues to be there for them and for the generations that come after us. You know, I've been able to serve in this work, and it's been the most incredible joy. I know I'm coming up to time, so I'll tell you quickly, like, the last 12 months have been the hardest of my life and the hardest of my sobriety. On June 17th, I lost my mother. On October 18th, I got a phone call from my niece to tell me that my brother had been found dead in his apartment. That day was the single hardest day I've had in sobriety. And what carried me through that And the way that I moved forward was the things that I learned here. I knew immediately I wasn't alone, and I reached out to someone and I told her, hey, this is what happened. Could you please tell everybody? Just tell everybody. I don't know if I can reach out, but I need to hear from people. And I started getting phone calls and I started getting texts. And I knew that I had to do like a whole bunch of stuff, and I wasn't sure what to do next. But by doing everything here, I knew that we took it one step at a time. So I did that one step at a time. What's the next thing I have to do? What's the next thing I have to do? It helps a lot that the funeral director that I tend to use is somebody I sat on a young people's committee with and is a very good friend. So like just showing up and like seeing him, like the hug in the parking lot was huge. But there were other things, decisions that have to make. And like I've been a trusted servant in my home group. And in concept three, we talk about the right of decision and when you need to make those decisions. And then sometimes it's really important to consult with other people beforehand. And because I've been doing that for like 30 years in AA, it gave me an understanding of how to do that with my family. And like, you know, I go for it and suddenly I get this gut twinge like, oh, I should probably check in with everybody now. And it made the process smoother. But what got me through all of it was that for 32 years, Alcoholics Anonymous had been pouring love into me. And in the moment that I needed it, it was there. And I thought about all the people I met along the way. And every single lesson I learned, whether it's from the steps, the traditions, or the concepts. There's a beautiful thing in the warranties about not being punitive. Really good for someone like me. Like, oh, so somebody upset you. You're probably angry, frustrated, and rebellious. Let's just not be a jerk. And like, it really, that's like, obviously paraphrase. But like being able to hold that, like being able to like take a deep breath, call the right person, show up in the way, like the sober woman that I am today for my family, because suddenly I was the head of the family. I'm like, okay. And you know, it's been hard, but I'm okay. And it's that feeling of like being perfectly okay and being full of grief at the same time. AA taught me how to deal with that and how to show up and to do other things. Like, I'm super excited for this weekend. There's a giant service assembly in Albany, New York, so I'm going to go spend it with like 1,000 of my great friends. And we're going to be talking about service and crazy things all, but I'm a service nerd, and I could talk to you about the concepts all day long. Some of the people in this room will like vouch for that. But I get to show up and do that because I know that by showing up there and by doing the work we do there, the message of Alcoholics Anonymous is going to be here for generations to come, just like it was here for all of us. So thank you for letting me be here tonight. It is such a gift to be at a meeting. Congratulations again to everybody who celebrated, and thank you.
We encourage all attendees to participate fully in our meeting and to have a service position. If you would like to be of service, please see our jobs coordinator. I don't think